someone's trying to move from the old SOC to the new space of detection and response, and they just don't know what to do and what to expect. And I think that's where the conversation begins. You know, most of the time, I actually don't even go talking about, you know, what can solve their problem. I try to talk to them about what are the issues and what are the really crunching points that they're dealing with today, and where can the new SOC fit in?
This is the Detection at Scale podcast, a new show designed to help security practitioners succeed at managing and responding to threats at a modern cloud scale. As the volume of data increases and the attack surface expands, it's never been more important to stay ahead of the curve. Each episode will feature interviews with leading security practitioners, thought leaders, and company founders who are building the next generation of security tools. I'm your host, Jack Naglieri, founder and CEO of Panther Labs. Now let's get into today's show. Welcome back to season two of the Detection at Scale podcast. Today I'm here with Dhruv Majumdar. I hope I nailed your name.
Yeah, that's correct.
He is a director of cyber risk and advisory at Deloitte. Dhruv, super excited to have the conversation today. How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, thanks a lot, Jack, for having me on the podcast. I've been a huge fan of it. So finally get to be here. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So you have a really interesting background, and I'm really interested to pick your brain in a few areas. Before we hit record, we were just sort of catching up. And, you know, one of the things that you started talking about I thought was really interesting is, as a consultant, you have the benefit of peering into a lot of organizations and really understanding what it is that they're doing and what their needs are. So I was hoping you could just start by talking a little bit about, like, one, like, what are the things that everyone is looking for when it comes to detection, or maybe what are the key commonalities that you see? And then the second part I would ask a question about is, how do you advise people to tailor their programs for their own individual threat models?
No, that's awesome. I think great questions. Let me start with the first one. You know, the common thing that I do see in the consulting life with most of my clients, big or small, actually, I don't deal with the small zone, but mid to large clients. One of the most common, you know, factor that I always come across is they're trying to solve the same problem that we have probably seen, you know, 5 years back or even 10 years back, but they think putting a new tool in place will solve that magically. A lot of the other problem that's kind of in the same realm is the fact that someone's trying to move from the old SOC to the new space of detection and response, and they just don't know what to do and what to expect. And I think that's where the conversation begins. You know, most of the time, I actually don't even go talking about, you know, what can solve their problem. I try to talk to them about what are the issues and what are the really crunching points that they're dealing with today. And where can the new SOC fit in, not really replacing? And then that's your maturity model. You mature from stage one, and then you go to stage four, so to say. And I think that's one of the key things that I see on a repeat with most of the clients that I work with. And I think with today's economy, we can all appreciate that the budgets that they need to deal with are causing more questions around log retention, data. You have PCI compliance, you have other compliances, you have NARC SIPs and stuff. So what do you do with data? And then the question becomes, well, if you are taking this data in, what's the value in this data? If not, why are you taking the data? And I guess that's where the conversation begins, Jack, end of the day. And based on the client's appetite, this conversation leads to focusing predominantly from SCADA or your IoT environment, and then slowly moving into the business, or the vice versa. Your business becomes more priorities and you slowly move into your SCADA, or now with cloud, you slowly piggyback on cloud implementations that they're starting to do, help with the best practices really and the strategies that can help them for their future use cases.
So you said a lot in there I'm really interested to dig into. The first one is, you said that there's a movement from the old SOC to the new space of DNR, and how there's like an expectation setting that has to really come into play when you're introducing new tools. Can you talk a little bit about that transition? Like, what is that transition? What is the old way and what's the new way?
The old way, depending on how old I want to pull it back to, let's go back to ArcSight, because that's where I got started. you know, you have the problems of, you know, your search just doesn't work. You're crunching terabytes of data. It's not going to report back. And you have the problem of data retention, data loading, reporting, really fast tracking an analyst's life and investigations. That's number one. Number two is you're still in the maturity model, probably at the initial or the ad hoc, where you're probably just doing a signature-based match, provided you are collecting the right logs. You know, there is a tremendous problem of standardization and normalization of logs to begin with. And then you are following in whatever you are collecting end of the day. You're trying to do some rule-based match on hashes or alerts that might have been triggered by your old school AVs. Now, as AVs have transitioned to EDRs, EDR is bringing in some of the old school AVs still, but along with some pattern-based and behavioral-based detections, or nowadays really looking into applications, you're kind of opening in as to what the kernel calls are, who is talking to whom, what DLLs are being loaded, and you get more data end of the day and trying to make sense of that and baselining the environment and then starting to trigger some incidents or alerts, so to say. And that becomes your new EDR. But as the growing appetite of data increases, we definitely needed to find a solution. Thus, I guess the inception of a little bit of move from the SIEM word to data lake, and we can talk a bit about that, and opening up the gates for really big data, because now you're ingesting so much data, you first need to really host the data somewhere. Then you need to make sure that the data that you are really bringing in is normalized and standardized. And then you have the issue of how do I enrich the data during the ETL process? And then what do I really do with the data? Are you doing behavior matching? Are you doing machine learning? Are you doing just pattern recognition? Are you doing any kind of other user behavior anomaly detections on them? And even the questions of really matrix generation. Now, my view on all these is, end of the day, it's not the question of which one is more important. I think you need to be able to do all of that and faster. So thus the inception of so-called, you know, the big data lake, or the, you know, the word that we probably leverage today, and it might very well change in the next couple of more years as we move from the big data lake to something even bigger or a more optimized. But going back to old to new, DNR really is needed because it's not only about, hey, I detected because there was an alert. It's the question of the attacker was in the system for not 72 hours to 120 days. The attacker was in the system for 5 minutes, and I got them out within the next 10 minutes. So in total duration, 15 minutes of longevity, and then they're out. Now, in order for you to do that, you definitely need to optimize all detections that you have today. And not just that, you have to make sure the processes are in place that allows response or SOAR to kick in to do some automated actions, or you have a playbook and really nice, well-defined roles and responsibility, the whole RBAC and RACI, that allows you to do a full-blown response when needed at a very high speed. So it's a very different mentality, I think, from the old school SOC to the new DNR.
There's so many things that we can dive into in that. The one that caught my ear the most, though, you talk a lot about maturity models, and I think maturity models can be a really helpful way for people to both understand like what their North Star is, but also understand where they are today. So is the maturity model that you're referencing something that's in open source land that people can go look at, or is this something that you sort of create per client?
No, the maturity model for, I think a really good question for people trying to understand these really simple things end of the day, I believe. But the maturity model that I refer to, I think it's a framework end of the day, and it's open source. I'm horrible while coding where I learned it first from, because, you know, we are in cyber, so we learn every day from everything that you probably can get our hands on to. But it's really well defined and it's simple. It is the initial and the ad hoc phase, and you have a well-defined phase where you're talking about your policies, your processes, your procedures, and then it's probably managed where you are now moving into a lot of, you know, incident management from end to end. You're documenting everything that has happened, thus allowing the old or documented investigations to pave way for the future and areas of strategic work and governance and controls, and then really moving it up to measured and optimized. Now, these are your five states. In measured, you're measuring what you are really valuing the most, your priorities. As I mentioned, I think everything is important. End of the day, what is your priority number one versus priority number 10 defines where you're going to put your money and your team's efforts to as a client or as a company. And I think most of the Fortune 500 or 50 companies are between somewhere in the measured to optimized. And that's where, like, I guess the optimized is where automation, you know, your detection as code or infrastructure as code or anything that is automated that allows the humans to focus back on actual R&D and taking away time from the repetitive work that they do, allowing the companies to, you know, focus on really things where they need to understand where the focus needs to be. And I think that's very strategic. That's what allows them to gain a superior maturity model, thus allowing that, okay, I need to focus on my email gateway, or should I be focusing on my application layer? Depending on, again, your threat landscape and your threat matrix that governs that particular line of business.
That's maybe a good segue. I mean, the threat modeling exercise is always super fascinating. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you've done that with clients, like how you recommend to them, hey, this is your company infrastructure, this is your threat model based on what I'm seeing, or, you know, maybe it's a collaborative effort, but maybe talk a little bit about how you come to that understanding so you can apply that to this maturity model.
Yeah, I think another good segue definitely. For clients, so again, it's a question that, you know, begins where we end up asking the client, you know, what's your main line of business? Right now, for some companies, it can be in the transportation sector, it can be your ticketing, or it can be your platform that actually through the application layer is probably talking directly to a SCADA layer, or it can be medical where everything's kind of in the old school days, but at the same time, it is very, very kinetic in nature, which basically means if they go down, you are looking at a lot more, you know, kinetic impact. And, you know, depending on what particular kind of client we deal with, these narratives change. And based on what is open, question one, to the public, and question two is, what is your so-called queen of your business and how do you save them, are the two most critical questions that we end up answering, or we try to find the answers to, so that we can start modeling as to where your right collection of logs to right enforcement of controls and policies are in place. And obviously, as you dig deeper, these conversations can, you know, move from you think your perimeter devices are doing this versus, you know, you need to do more auditing because what you thought is not what's happening. There are a lot more holes being opened that is not being vetted. You know, again, in the application layer, what kind of APIs are accessible and what kind of mechanisms have you put in place, thus allowing, you know, fuzzing tactics or other kind of API fuzzing to happen and thus opening up more gates. And as clients move to cloud, this vector of attack is increasing because now you're not only dealing with your own applications that you're queen of the business, but you are also dealing with vendor supports that are now also opening up your environment for those specific kind of attacks. Or really the question can become, or, you know, very easily we can flip it and say, well, now you don't even know what your attack vectors are because of these XYZ. And I guess that's where, again, the conversation begins. That's where you need to pull in resources that have the understanding of those particular technologies or tool stacks that can talk about and educate the clients and, you know, help them really to figure out that, okay, these are the right ways to proceed to that particular maturity model. Year one, you tackle all these. Year two, you tackle the rest of the segment that's there. And I'm saying years, but really in security world, depending on, again, budgets and resources, the years can very well become weeks. So you need to do this in weeks and you do that in the next week.
So you said the queen of the business. What do you mean by that?
What I really mean by the queen of the business is basically if you are a nuclear power plant and your main area that makes your business successful is everything to do with SCADA. So the question should not begin with how is my business doing on the business world of IT. The question should really begin from, is my SCADA air gap and is the air gap actually vetted on a regular basis? If there are new vulnerabilities, if there are new matrix, if there are new vectors added, how do we get to know that and make sure that that particular work that is of the most kinetic impact is taken care of and is well protected? And that same ideology changes if you are in a medical world or in a banking world. are your mainframes really segregated from the other worlds of the business? And at the same time, what you think is segregated is actually done. And that's where, you know, more controls, more auditing, and thus more detection and, you know, other things come in.
That's super interesting. You know, the other thing too, I was thinking a lot about is, what do you typically find is the connection between line of business and the type of detection you need to do? Because I've always wondered that. Is it more around the tools, the techniques? Like, what are you seeing as those patterns? And I'm wondering if there's any takeaways that can help others on the pod.
Well, I mean, thanks to COVID, we have moved to that world, and I can't blame it. I think it has a lot of merits for researchers who love reading up, and they save some time and they get to read more than spending it on travel. But at the same time, I completely understand and office time and stuff. But going back to Jack, your original question, which is something that I preach to my team all the time or other colleagues all over the world, is a threat is a threat. And the meaning of this is very, really simple on its nature, is because you are a financial institution or because you are in the farming or the agricultural sector, does not necessarily mean that you turn off some detections that is necessary for the other organization. Now, what it means, as I mentioned, in the maturity model, you have the initial, which might be based on simple IOC matches, simple, SHA-256 matches or like hash match, or maybe just TTPs that are your so-called, you know, Sigma logics are there, and you piggyback on the Sigma logics, or you develop something internally. It doesn't really matter. You're writing some kind of a TTP, and that TTP allows you to gain more information on something that is now an anomaly. And that particular nature, and I'm talking about the very basic part of this, the basic nature of this doesn't really change much for organizations to organizations. Where it really starts changing is the behavior of one application talking to another application, or the way the enhanced logging that you would need to do. So if I can simplify it even a bit more, let's say you have, you know, 200 use cases, 150 is probably used by all organizations and it needs to be used. Now, how you optimize the 150 is up to you, but end of the day, it will be leveraged. But out of the 170, you're left with 20. This 20 will change based on what kind of organization you are, what is your priority, what is your landscape. Are you more cloud-focused versus are you more vendor-driven? By vendor-driven, I mean, is everything handled by a SASE provider, or is it like an IaaS provider, or are things all in-house? Are you a hybrid, or are you a shop that is living completely in cloud? And that narrative drives the last part of it. And I guess that's from the detection part. And obviously, this has its trickling down impacts on how you would respond to all these different incidents. But again, the basics that everyone can, I believe it's 2023. So, you know, where people can really up their game and really should look that, okay, these things are being taken care of, it is that the simple things that should be done is done. And that doesn't really need to change based on what kind of organization you are.
That's super interesting. I mean, we talk a lot about the 80-20 rule, right? Like every organization probably has 80% of the same rules as another, and then the 20% is up for them to tailor and specialize.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe it's a good segue. So in talking about the transition from traditional to data lakes, and by the way, I wrote a really long blog post about this on my Substack. And if anyone's listening and you're curious and want to read more, it basically talks about like the transition and all the pieces that make that work. But I guess the question that comes to my head, which I don't talk about in the blog post, is more around like the new capabilities that we can use for detection and response as a result of that transition. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that with regards to, you know, you effectively have this big data platform available and you now have access to apply things like machine learning and more. So maybe let's talk about like what's been unlocked with that transition when it comes to detection and response with access to big data now.
Yeah, I think I want to tackle the same question in two different slices. The first slice being the advent of, you know, detection as code. Choose your language, write what you want. May that be Python, Go, Rust. and the second advent being the big data itself, or the data lakes itself. Now, I want to tackle the first slice being the big data. What we really unlock with the big data is not getting trapped by a vendor with the capabilities that you inherently possess. Now, what I mean by that is aggregation or enrichment or any kind of ETL processing or things that was in your wild imaginations that you wanted to bring to life. You just couldn't do it as an analyst or as an engineer because of the lockdown that you would see from whatever the toolset that you would be leveraging. However awesome the tool itself be, but you couldn't really do what you thought is an awesome thing to even try. And that got changed significantly. And, you know, going back to big data also allowed to re-leverage the same data in multiple different slices. What I mean by that is, in one way, you can now stream the data, which basically means you can, it's very easy to mix a data that's all about, you know, your application logs, where you know, one API is talking to another, or a user, you know, mostly interacting with some kind of a, you know, application server, and you have now two separate streams of logs, and you want to write a behavior anomaly on top of this that basically says, you know, how many times have the user done this in this particular application subset. And previously, if you would want to do that, you would have multiple issues of how do you handle that throughput first, and how do you merge all these real-time enrichment data into another streaming data that thus allowing maybe not an alert, so to say. I mean, with the big data, I moved away from the word alert, but basically coming to a conclusion of an anomalous event or something that needs further investigation, may that by be a machine or by be a human. So that's the big data part. The detection as a code part, which, you know, again, I would say you guys are doing a phenomenal job in that. The detection as a code part that we took on back in 2017, 2016, without knowing the name, was basically trying to automate all these and all these wild imaginations. Like, okay, I know that for a company, maybe they're having some issues with insider threats, and maybe my query just needs to be, you know, how many times has these particular users downloaded stuff from, you know, the SharePoint? And, you know, what has that caused? And is this normal? And has this happened in the last 6-7 days prior to that day you're running your hypothesis? And once that code is written, doesn't matter how you write it, and I say code in kind of an abstract way, because if that's now your new use case, that your detection is, well, every time I want to know if anyone in the environment is downloading massive amount of data from a SharePoint, that is my trigger point. And that's what I want to write. Previously, to do that, it would have costed me a lot of resource, especially with the amount of data, again, because significant increment of the data, especially if you're dealing with really large clients. And how do you run that? And then what do you do with that data? Maybe that data is not meant for alerting. That data just needs to go into another data lake where that data is now being fed to a machine learning. And the machine learning, all it's doing is, hey, I have seen this happening 3 months ago, so this is probably normal. Or it's saying, well, no, I haven't seen this in the last 60 days. That's abnormal. So, you know, flag it. As simple as that. But this flexibility and the speed of visualizing a hypothesis and then making that come to life, I think, is one of the biggest thing that I've seen happen in the last couple of years. And obviously, now that you have automation, why leave out SOAR capabilities, right? So that's your response. And now sometimes it's half augmented, sometimes it's done via a playbook or whatever you sign with the client. But, you know, you have that potential extra work that a human had to do now can be done by a machine.
There's so many things in there I want to reply to. Okay, so the first thing I want to ask a clarifying question on is making the transition to big data. You mentioned that handling different streams of data and enriching it and joining them and all those things becomes easier, but I would actually argue that it becomes a little harder. And one of the things I was going to ask is, like, what are the trade-offs that you make in terms of usability? Like, what are the usability trade-offs from moving to a data lake-backed architecture versus a traditional SIEM? Because I think inherently there are a lot of usability differences, but at the benefit of being able to scale, having things a bit more mature in terms of your analytical capability. You know, you mentioned feeding things into a machine learning model. And I agree that that's a great use case for doing analysis over your logs. But the core question is, like, what do you see as like the trade-offs of usability? And does that actually affect the outcome of being able to do detection easier, or are the benefits so like outweighing that it doesn't really matter?
I would like to talk about the potential of the big data that I've seen personally in my own experience. Is with SIEM, the biggest issue was, is my SIEM always up and running, actually? Can it actually pull, you know, 4 terabytes of data and present me what I want in a right amount of time? And then very easily, let's say, whatever be the report, that report goes into another data stream for some other kind of work. Now, this particular segment, I have seen to be a traditionally an issue and a manual task in SIEM, provided it's always up and running and all that other issue regarding data handling itself. Now, the other caveat that we have seen was, and I don't know if it's only, well, I mean, I personally believe it is nothing to do with SIEM. It's what clients ended up doing. It was, they were sending logs, whatever be the log, and sometimes they were not even in the right schema, not right the format, and all these other things that's causing more issues than it solves the problem. So where we came in and wanted to solve the problem was, we know the data sets we want to get. We have the right schema. So which basically means I'm solving the problem of the data aggregation and the right way of data aggregation, thus normalizing and standardization, and then opening up the gateway for a, you know, do what you want, you know, kind of a free for all, do what you want with that data. And again, the question is, how many times can I do the queries? And again, because we have the capabilities now with automation, it's no longer a question of, well, do I have, you know, 4 servers that's serving me 120 cores to do this particular search or resource intensive work? Versus, well, I have containers that can spin up and down depending on what query I end up writing, basically scaling horizontally, thus knowing that, okay, this is what I want to do, and I won't have a bottleneck and causing or tripping something that's not going to be working end of the day. So again, it's more about, I guess, the ad hoc nature that you are able to now simplify and present to an engineer or to a data scientist or to an operator in the SOC world, than what it used to be with just a SIEM tool.
Yeah, I think the things you called out are important. So what I heard is, you know, the uptime element of a data lake, and the, you know, that's very tightly coupled with the fact that you're not thinking so hard about, like, is this search going to finish at all, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the platform benefits do unlock a lot. I fully agree with that. And you also mentioned that an emphasis on data engineering opens up the gateway of what you can really do with highly structured data, which I also very much agree with. The thing that I find that is a trade-off is with the simpler, like, full text search based SIEMs that are operating at a smaller scale, it's easier to correlate across them because the data is just smaller, right? Of course, like, you still have the same problems that you mentioned, which is, if I'm going to run this over a large data set, it's likely it might not work, right? So I think that that platform foundation is really, really key. The thing that I think the vendors have to be responsible for is, like, if they are making the transition, which not all of them have, you know, I like to proudly say that I think Panther was probably one of the first ones to make that jump from, or really to start fully cloud native and on data lake, because I don't really know if others did.
No, I think you wouldn't be wrong seeing that or that claim. I think you're absolutely correct.
If I'm wrong, someone can correct me. I actually would love to understand, because, you know, I think a big thing that I wish I did more of was explain that transition, because I think there's a really big reset of expectations when you make that jump, because it's a lot harder to correlate. When you have a data lake, there's just different requirements, and it's harder to implement some of the same things that we were doing in the old world at this scale. So I think there's a little bit of expectation setting that has to happen, but at the benefit, as you're saying, which is, it's going to scale a lot better. It's going to future-proof you a lot better. And more importantly, you're now set up to take advantage of this big wave that's happening in AI, right? Like, all these big data platforms, what do they require? Highly structured data. How are you going to get that any other way? Like, you need a data lake. That's, I think it's, like, it's just non-negotiable. Like, what else are you going to do, right? Like, you have to adopt it. And I think that transition is really important. And then the vendors need to fill in the gaps and be creative about like, how are we going to add detection and response value on that data? Because there's a lot changing really rapidly in the space. So I guess the last part I think I'd love to talk with you about is, what are you seeing in the evolution of not only to data lakes, but to taking it a step further to applying the advances in AI that we've had in the last 1 year on this data? So, you know, you've mentioned a little bit that you have some experience with LLMs in security. So I would love to just wrap up the pod with this and then obviously the three pieces of advice, but why don't we go to this part of the conversation?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I think, Jack, one thing for all the listeners, I think, and people that knows me, they're probably going to be having a small smirk with this. I do not advocate for AI yet. I am a believer in it, not an advocate yet. Fully agree on the machine learning and the advent of machine learning, what LLMs are allowing us to do. Now, LLMs today, if you're talking about just LLMs today, what it would help you do is really summarize and contextualize and allow pattern to pop up a lot better than what a human would be able to do with a ridiculous size of a data. Now, that's where the advent is, and that's where we are today using it. But also at the same time, it opens up gateways with these models and all other subsets of it. So let's get into one technical bit, I guess. Today, you can very easily just leverage LSTM models and detect if you have an exfiltration happening. Now, yes, will you pick up backup also happening with an offsite zone? Yes. And that's where your suppression comes in and you do what you want to do with your data comes in. But end of the day, the question of, well, how easy is it for me to actually look at data exfiltration from my corporate zones or my corporate network? The answer is, well, if you have the data structured and you are leveraging the machine learning models accurately, it actually becomes fairly simple and fairly vivid, even from just looking at patterns, because end of the day, you're looking at a graph and you will definitely see a spike. The machine learning comes in. The machine learning will be allowing you to also dictate that, okay, this is a known spike or this is a not known spike, and thus leveraging an investigation or, you know, look into that further. Now, where does this stop? Really, we don't know yet, I think, because you can really take this simple model and put it into lateral movements. You can put it into cloud access or API access, and you can put it into user behaviors like login anomalies as well. Like I log in every day at 8:30. Am I logging at 12:30 at night? And answering those questions very, very quickly. Yes, am I generating more data points for analysts to look at? Again, that's where automation, and you always have to build an abstract and then use, you know, data to understand that abstract for your environment. But really the question is, am I able to do this at a very high speed? The answer is yes. Can I do a whitelisting that will allow me to only focus on things that actually stands out? And is there a machine-assisted automation that I can do? Again, not machine learning, just machine-assisted action that I can do that will allow my analyst to come to a conclusion of this was actually a known activity or something that the user have done because of XYZ, or the user have not really done this and this is actually malicious, and you know, follow the playbook, do what you need to do after that.
I feel like we need another hour. Oh, man. It's super interesting.
It's a great field to be in for people that talks about burnout. I personally started out as an analyst as well. You know, so I can feel for the burnout folks. But I would say if you follow on the wins and the amount of, I don't know, head butting that you have to do to come to the right conclusion and why you should wake up tomorrow to do security again and fuel the burnout again, it's a fantastic domain to be in, especially in 2023, moving towards 2024. The more people go into cloud, I guess more vectors will be opening up. I do see fantastic researchers coming out every now and then. So that's amazing. And I do see that the community is growing, which is great. The part that I do not see much happening, and I don't really know, like I personally haven't really deciphered that as to how I can make that happen, is train the new generation of operatives to be able to understand geopolitics and cyber and demography and the threat matrix they belong to. Because end of the day, cyber is a war and you need to treat it like a war. Just because it's happening on machines doesn't really mean you can sit tight and do nothing.
Oh man, that hits home, especially I'm spending some time out near DC right now. And I always think security is such an interesting intersect of defense and innovation, right? And exactly what you're saying makes a lot of sense. Having that like that adversary mindset, I think is important, and you always have to be on. And I think that's probably why security folks are classified as paranoid. When I worked at Yahoo, actually, that was the name of the security team. It was the Paranoids. And I guess Yahoo is now under Verizon. I believe the team name still exists. But, you know, the stay paranoid mindset, I think Andy Grove also has a book, Only the Paranoid Survive, right? Like, it's very, very timely. But yeah, Drew, I mean, this has been super interesting. I feel like I could talk to you about this stuff for a really long time and go into like a lot of depth on how you could use some of the advances in AI. Maybe we can talk about one quick example. Like what?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
You know, you said you're not a huge believer in using AI yet. I mean, can you talk me through that for a second and then maybe explain like, what are you seeing as like the really helpful use cases for AI and security and then the use cases that you think it's just not ready yet or people aren't thinking about it in the right ways?
So let me answer this in just a little bit different way, and maybe it's going to help our listeners to understand my mentality on not being a believer in the AI as of right now. I believe that the word artificial intelligence, basically meaning if you dissect the words, artificially incorporated intelligence, and intelligence stands for, you know, how do you dissect a thought or a verbatim or a discussion or any kind of moral or philosophical or creative aspect into multiple different ways, right? You know, imagine you have a knife. How sharp is your knife? Is your intellect? And intelligence being how many times can you, you know, cut it and get to different conclusions. Now, their right or wrong is not a battle I want to fight today, but I'm talking about the paradigms you can come out from that zone. So in what's happening predominantly with AI today is, you know, if I have to break it down, it's basically a whole bunch of features that works in different tandems, becoming a model, and that model is allowing a pattern to be recognized or a telemetry to be generated, thus allowing for some kind of assisted answering. Now, the fundamental problem with this is how do you govern the data that you are leveraging in the model to begin with? How do you understand that the features that you have worked on are actually correct and they don't need optimizations? And it goes into, again, maybe a non-tech route, but more of a philosophical round, is really for an artificial intelligence to really come to life, it needs to be consciously creative. Now, someone can come back and say, hey, Drew, but you know, artificial intelligence is now being creative with all the stuff they're doing. But if you really dig deep into that, it's a combination of what it has seen versus what it is generating in a different way. It's not really a conscious creation of a new idea that was not really there before. Before the thought was created. So again, it's a thought versus actionable item problem, I guess. Thus me not being part of the whole AI inception, but nonetheless, I'm a huge believer in what I am seeing with, let's say, GPTs, you know, a billion token being leveraged today versus 1,000 versus 1,000,000 and what it's allowing us to be able to do. So I think there is a huge future. It just, I think people should focus on the basics first today. Because you are still not looking at your logs correctly. You don't even know what logs you need. So wasting time on throwing all my logs just to a machine learning model with an AI is not going to solve your problem. So that's where I want to refocus the mass and say, focus on the basics first. Yes, there are new things happening. Those are all exciting. Focus as priority needs. And then don't get sold by someone that says, hey, you know, I have a magic pill. Throw all your data into this cloud. It's going to solve everything with AI and machine learning.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think we've been guilty about that in security for a long time. I mean, there's been plenty of systems that are backed by, you know, quote unquote machine learning. And then I think there's been, again, the wrong expectations set with the users of those systems that, oh, the fidelity of this is, you know, your mileage is going to vary. And I think security is such a hard thing because it's very gray.
Plus users, to add on the complexity, you have users that does what they do. Now, good or bad, again, I'm not commenting, but they do what they do, which is so unpredictable.
Yeah, that's true. But I think the the point is we need to understand the best use cases for things like machine learning. And I think the beauty with what I've been seeing lately is, you know, obviously NLP, I think, can really help a lot with response, right? Like NLP, I think objectively is very applicable for helping response. We're actually seeing a lot of startups pop up just focused on this, and especially with Security Copilot from Microsoft.
Yeah.
And I think Charlotte AI from CrowdStrike, right? These are all really similar concepts of how do we just make response faster? I think that's been widely accepted as the best use case for things like NLP. But I think the two things I want to say is I think one, we should always be treating AI as like of getting us 80 to 90% of the way there. And then the human is the last 10%, which isn't too different from what we were talking about before, which is there's 80% of the detections that exist in every company, and then you sort of use human intuition to fill in the others or to tweak and tune it. But I think AI is just a lot more interesting because it leapfrogs a lot of manual steps that you were doing before. So
totally. Yeah. I mean, that's where I like it today. Like I was just having a discussion with my group of data scientists that there were a couple of things that we wanted to do maybe back in 2 years ago and would take us a week to automate that, or maybe 3 days to automate that, whereas it takes less than 30 minutes nowadays, just because of the availability of this data. And even with threat intelligence, like from 2016, there were certain manual processes that we used to do, thus allowing us to know what are really the TTPs we need to focus based on the market that we're helping, based on the attackers we are seeing, based on what kind of tools, techniques, and procedures they're using. With large language models, coming to that conclusion is so easy and so quick. But the challenge still remains with machine learning to be very, very successful. You need to really invest a lot into the subject matter expertise who are auditing the result and the result that the machine's creating. And end of the day, the labeling of the data, because if the labeling goes wrong, that machine learning model is as good as another world war, probably.
Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, I think we're going to see some incredible advancements in security, particularly in shortening the time to response. I think in detection, it's still the same. I don't think it's really changed. I mean, maybe there's some new models and some like better ways of doing processing. Maybe I'm going to eat my words in like a month. But you know, I think more or less the point I'm trying to make is like, if we set the expectation of like, hey, this is the best use case for this type of machine learning, because this is such a broad spectrum of what you could be doing with the data. But just as long as we're using it in the right context, I think it's important. I agree with you that AI and LLMs is not a blanket technology. It's going to, you know, solve our security problems. And oftentimes it's like the simplest thing that causes someone to get breached, like, you know, phishing, right? Like just tricking people. That is literally the easiest way to get around anything. You know, I always think about the parallels of like physical security and cybersecurity, and it's the same, right? You can put all these physical defenses in the same place, but what's the way that you get in? You just trick somebody. And you know, there's movies about this all the time, right? Like someone tricking someone who has all this privileged access, and then they break into the bank or whatever, right? It's like, it's the same story every time. So
you're very correct, Jack. I think like my challenge today in end of the day always ends up being, it's not that the threat actors won't be able to get in. I mean, everything that we have discussed tells you probably that. I probably already think all companies are always hacked to begin with. The question is, how have you detected it, and what's allowing you to detect it fast and kick them out of the network as quickly as possible, end of the day? And why I do say that you are hacked, it's not because it's always not necessary that you have a threat actor coming after you. It can be a malicious user in your org. It can be someone's laptop that was left open on a hotel lobby. That's all it takes, right? So, and the intent was not maybe to have a bad USB plugged into it, but did that data get leaked? And then that data, can it be used in an offensive way for your organization? And if the answer is yes, you are probably already dealing with another vector. So the concept is, you know, end of the day is what's normal you need to understand. And then based on what's normal to you, what stands out? And I think that's where machine learning can help or is helping. Like I think When you talked about the detection, I think one area of significant improvement that we have seen in the last couple of months or year maybe is understanding parent-child processes or DLLs being loaded by this particular process, or even going down even deeper into handles and triggers and whatnot. And using machine to do that is a lot faster than, you know, what we could have done with just single line logs and looking at that from a human standpoint. Whereas you put those into a segregated data set where it's a regressive learning happening on them. And there are subject matter experts that can do the R&D side and say, okay, this is right, this is wrong. But then once that model is done, you're only probably tuning that model every 3 to 6 more months or updating the model. But end of the day, it's probably going to give you a solid result back. And that probably will be suspicious that this has not happened in the past. This is abnormal to you and go investigate.
The thing I always find fascinating with using normality in detection is that if the attacker just mimics what you normally do, they might actually subvert the model, right? Unless the model also takes into account things like user agents and it's just like doing a little bit more holistic like looks. But I think just generally the statement of like, oh, well, baseline and normal, and if, you know, it goes out of normal, it's bad. It's like, well, I mean, yes, humans are creatures of habit, but you know, I occasionally will open my laptop at a different time. And, you know, I hope that I'm not, you know, sending an alert to some poor soul on the other side of that to, you know, say like, oh, well, Jack was checking his email again at 3 a.m. You know, he did that last month, right? Like, I don't ever do that, by the way. I'm like a big believer in sleep. But anyway, I just think it's an interesting thought process because even with all the machine learning applied, it's still not foolproof for security. I think that's what makes it hard is you have to get really good at mimicking and understanding human behavior. That's at the end of the day what we're doing. And I think we forget that by it getting masked over things like MITRE attacks framework and all these other things. But at the end of the day, again, what we're doing mimics the real world. How are we, you know, for protecting our base, what are we looking at? We're looking at the movement of people through our system. And then we're looking for deviations or things that are just obvious, like very easy things like, oh, well, someone kicked the front door in at, you know, 2 a.m, right? That's a very obvious, and a rule for that's very basic too. It's like, oh, this sensor went off, right? Like that's very simple, but it gets much more complicated when you're looking for impersonation and you're looking for all these different types of things that can lead to breach. And all these tools and platforms and things are just ways of making that easier. And now that we've evolved to the data lake world, we're still having the same challenges. It's just a matter of like, can we do a better job now with the technology that we have and make an impact on the lives of the people who are in charge of watching over the organizations that are trying to protect their IP or protect their customers or production environments or their finances or whatever it may be. So anyway, super interesting. My mind's like...
No, I definitely agree. I think the biggest thing that really happened was enabling certain folks to evolve from operators to engineers. And I think my hope is that in future, we actually don't really have operators. Everyone is an engineer because fundamentally they're very different because it's not only about detecting problems. Someone needs to fix those problems. And that's where the engineers comes in. So I believe having a whole fleet of engineers is always helpful, having different capabilities in different segments of cyber. And I think that's the world I would love to see. And I don't really know. I am hopeful and I'm very, rooting forward, you know, that direction because of, again, a lot of these advent that's happening. But, only time will tell, I guess.
Yep. So just to close things off for the day, it is the end of the day where I am. I think it is for you too. I think we're on the same time zone.
We are in the same time zone, yeah.
So can you drop 3 pieces of advice for folks listening in on maybe navigating this transition into the new world? And, you know, I think you dropped a ton of pieces of advice, but maybe like your top 3 favorite pieces of advice that you think that most people need to hear going through the transition from the old world to the new world, which I think we spent a lot of time talking about today.
Yeah, I think let's try. The first one that I would love for everyone to really understand is the beauty of overcoming a challenge is in the simplicity of the way to solve it. Now, what does that really mean? Is the simplest route that allows you to get to the optimized answer is always your best friend. Is that the 100% best fit? might be no, and that's not important. What is important is you get started and pick a challenge. So all the people that are there in trying to join the operations or trying to make a move to cybersecurity, I would strongly suggest tackle some challenge. May that be in the network, may that be in the cloud, may that be, you know, somewhere with automations or, you know, ML. Pick a topic and try to come to a conclusion along with any conclusion. Hopefully you are doing something for that conclusion. And that's your project that allows you to gain a deeper understanding of that particular topic and see how that can help a real world challenge. So in that way, you will obviously learn something. Might not be a real world use case, but you still end up learning a lot. And then the next part is, how can you implement that into a real world scenario? So that's number one, probably from my standpoint. For companies or clients that are, you know, looking at the world of cybersecurity, yes, a lot of technology has changed. Focus on not the hot words, but really focus on what is your need? What is your priority? If you are dealing with a, you know, budget being always a regular problem, if it's budget, find some company, find some individuals that can get you that level of understanding that you lack today in the organization, thus allowing for you to start your journey towards a cyber maturity model or the matured state of cyber. Now, that might require you to go join hands with other vendors or providers, but make that decision based on what you need, not because it's going to solve something and that's the website's saying that. So that's number two, I guess. Number three is controls, controls, controls. You can have the best detection and the response, but if you do not end up creating controls, policies, and at the same time, you're having clear responsibilities of your team, none of these works. The entire discussion of cyber will fall apart unless you really have doubled down on who is doing what, when, and how. What is your roadmap towards that particular project? What is your plan? And what is the bigger plan of this cyber maturity that you are taking a journey on? And obviously, as the organizations leap from one application to another, maybe join hands with another vendor that you end up working, it's not about how many times they got ransomware. What have they done after the ransomware has happened? That understanding of what they did is way more important than judging a company because they got ransomware twice. It's what the aftermath have they done, and are you comfortable taking that risk? Because you like it or not, you as a company shaking hands with someone who's another company with a big hole in their cyber frontier, you don't want to be shaking hands with that because that's opening up another hole to your company now. So, you know, doubling down on what you say yes to. And really, end of the day, I think something that I've heard in my group of colleagues is the constant fight of CISOs not getting a chair at the board level. It's not important about getting the chair, but it's very important to hear what the CISO really has to say and how that really impacts the business overall. So keeping all that in mind, I think you would always come to a very humble opinion that end of the day, it's your company. It's what you need to do best for your company, and how you want to do it is literally up to you.
Dhruv, thanks so much for your time today, your insight, your knowledge. This is super interesting. I think I'm going to go journal for like the next 2 hours on all the stuff that we talked about, but really appreciate the time and hope everyone listening in really enjoyed our conversation. So yeah, I hope we can keep in touch and maybe have you on again at some point.
No, definitely. Thanks a lot, Jack, for doing this. I think great cause. So keep doing it. I hope the season two is even better than season one. But season one was tough to beat. You had some really, really awesome speakers, people that I really admire and people that have taught me of what I do today.
That's awesome. Glad to hear that.
Great. Yeah, keep it up.
Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Detection at Scale podcast brought to you by Panther Labs. For access to the latest episodes, please visit our website at www.runpanther.io/podcast. And for those interested in running Panther, head to our website, runpanther.io, to sign up for a free trial. You'll get a dedicated instance with the ability to analyze your security logs in real time at any scale powered by detections as code and sending into a very robust security data lake. Our goal is to make detection and response easy, scalable, and fast for you, the practitioner. Thanks. See you again next time.